Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are looking at a part of a series that we're hoping to build upon across the Tortoise Shack, if I'm honest. And it tallies very much what we were doing in terms of Reboot Republic, but we are calling this No Going Back. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Martin McMahon. Martin, how are you?
Well, I'm good at not going back, Tony. It's something I've been doing most of my life, so I'm glad to have this discussion.
Look, much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined via Zoom in the Tortoise Shack by a BBC World Service journalist, one of the soundest guys around, actually, Ellis Palmer. Mr. I have on my Twitter handle the Pod Guy. Well, I would say Pod Junior. Ellis is the master of the podcast world. Ellis, how are you keeping, buddy?
I guess you call a first time caller, but a long time listener. I'm very, very good, Tony. Very, very good. I've been addictively listening to your podcast from here on the Wirral Peninsula in Merseyside, about 250 kilometres from where I normally base, but it's going pretty well, this self isolation so far.
I was just going to ask,
are you in a holiday home?
No. I'm back home. This is where I'm from originally. I just work down in London. I'm from up here originally. So basically, as soon as I got wind, but what's going to be a partial confinement, lockdown, social distancing period, I made the decision to come back to the beautiful Wirral Peninsula. And I've got like a beach less than 2 kilometres away from me. I've got Birkenhead Park, which New York Central Park was based upon, like a mile down the road, so it's pretty decent around here, really, you know.
Ellis, I suppose one of the main reasons when we were talking about doing this, and you straight away came to mind, is because as a person with disabilities like yourself, you have encountered how society has often, we've had this conversation ourselves privately, how society is the thing that sometimes disables you and not thing. And we were kind of thinking that this is the first time. Do you want to give the listeners an idea of what we kind of discussed about this?
Oh, shucks. I forgot to mention the fact that I've actually got a disability in my introduction there. But yeah, I've got cerebral palsy. I'm a wheelchair user. And to be honest with you, it can be quite frustrating on a day-to-day basis, having to control your anger at the fact that so many things are inaccessible, getting around in day-to-day basis, public transport, shops, you know, employment opportunities, all these things are a lot more difficult when you are a disabled person. You know, I mean, say I go to Dublin, full credit to Dublin. I actually think the buses are absolutely phenomenal. The Dublin buses are great in terms of accessibility. But say I want to get the dart or something like that, I've got to get the station staff to put a ramp out for me. And that can be 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes extra onto my journey, which is quite a long time if you're trying to get somewhere as a kind of standard commuter. You can't just hop on and hop off like a normal non-disabled person would do. Normal in quotation marks, have a stress there. I usually live in London, work in London, and honestly, it can be a bit of a nightmare in London. You've got only 20% of tube stations in London are actually fully accessible for me as a wheelchair user. That means 80% I just can't even countenance using, and that makes it quite isolating in terms of trying to get around the city. You've always got to take money out of your own back pocket to, you know, you've got to get a taxi to see friends, or you've got to sit on a bus for 2 hours or something like that. It can be quite frustrating. And oftentimes, it's the extra time costs and financial costs associated with disability that can be really, really frustrating. So, say, wheelchairs are a lot more, you know, the more kind of specialised or zooped up or bespoke you go for a wheelchair, because let's be honest, it's something you're sitting in for 15, 16 hours a day, you're adding the zeros, basically. And same with public transport, same with transport in general, same with anything specialised, and that can be frustrating. Coming to the employment thing, though, I'm just going to get some stats up here. 10 seconds. Right. So in Ireland, The employment rate of persons with a disability was 28.6% in 2013. And coming to the results from the Census 2016, which is the most recent insight into the scale and nature of disability in Ireland, I must stress, this is in the 26 counties, the CSO reported that a total of 634,000 people had a disability in Ireland, and that's equivalent to 13.5% of the population. And the problem is that basically 46.1% of those people had have pain, breathing, or other chronic illness, and 40.9% of those people had physical barriers. And that's very, very difficult if you're having to go into a standard workplace, because the Irish legislation talks about reasonable accommodations rather than reasonable adjustments as part of the Equal Status Act 2015, I think, it's called. And that basically says that they have to provide reasonable accommodation or special treatment or facilities that would be impossible for you if you have a disability to access it. But that talks about a nominal cost, which makes things really, really difficult. If you're constantly talking about a nominal cost,
yeah,
then that means they're not going to make the adjustments if it's over a couple of euro, if you know what I mean. They're just going to go, oh, sorry, we can't do it. It's a lot of extra expense. So that makes it really, really difficult to get around and to engage when places just aren't willing to make things accessible
for disabled
people.
And when we look at it now through the context of COVID-19, and we see people who, and I'm going to use your phrase with non-disabled normal people, or you know, we'll use the terminology lightly and say that for the first time are finding themselves to be restricted, finding themselves having their freedoms curbed. You know, in Ireland, we can go 2 kilometres from the house now. We can't go out unless it's for essential shopping, and you can't go into somewhere to work unless you are essential service. The working from home phenomenon, that has to be something that now, as we say about no going back, can change ideas for people around. Because if we can see that the level of unemployment in the community of people with disabilities is phenomenal, and if there's potential there, it's untapped, clearly.
This is a problem around Europe, Tony. Here in the UK, an estimated 4.2 million disabled people are in employment. And that's against 7.9 million people of working age saying they have a disability, which is quite shocking. And in Spain, only 25% of disabled people are actually in employment. That means what? 75% of those people are not in employment. Now, first of all, COVID presents a heck of a lot of challenges for a lot of disabled people. If they've got chronic pain, breathing difficulties, issues like that, it makes it a lot more difficult for them to engage in their communities and get the support and care that they need when they need it, because it's very, very difficult for them to get the personal assistance that they need because they're high risk, etc. So that the coronavirus pandemic presents a problem of that nature. Presents a problem for them in terms of getting medicine and getting the little things they need, the social interactions they need on a day-to-day basis if they're not able to leave the house as a result of this pandemic. However, for the first time, many non-disabled people are facing the problems that disabled people have to face on a day-to-day basis. Inaccessible transport that's not available when you need it. Restrictions on where you're able to go, because maybe the pavements aren't level, or maybe you're going to get soaked through if you try and walk somewhere, or that kind of thing. People are facing the issues with big. It's a little insight, it's not a full insight, but they are getting a small insight into what it's like to be a disabled person on a day-to-day basis. And I think that this pandemic presents that problem. However, perhaps that means there can be no going back. No going back, at least to where we came from, for many non-disabled people and the community as a whole. Because surely, once people have had an insight to the inaccessibility that disabled people face on a day-to-day basis, transport problems, being able to get around your community, you know, not having the reasonable distance you need to be able to work from home, et cetera, et cetera. And surely that means there is going to be a change. And when it comes to things like reasonable accommodations, for the first time, a lot of non-disabled people are actually finding that things like the Equal Status Act and things like that in Ireland and the Equality Act in the UK are providing an outlet for them to get the support that they need, but they otherwise thought of. And from that perspective, remote working is really, really interesting because it could potentially rebalance the economy. You know, I was only thinking this morning about the National Children's Hospital.
Mm.
Why is that based in Dublin? You know, why isn't it based in Mullingar or Tullamore or Athlone? You know, it's easier for people to get to. That's not already overcrowding and overcrowded. It's not another development in a massively overcrowded city where housing prices are very high. Now, if you give people the facilities to be able to be productive from their own home, then that could potentially lead to a greater economic spread away from big cities and towards smaller towns and villages. Now, there exists something of a brain drain in Ireland, as there exists over here, with regard to the most talented people moving to the capital city. And that's a phenomenon that exists over the world. But when the most highest earners leave an area and move to another area, that means that all that potential money that could be spent in those shops, in that community, etc., isn't being spent in that area, it's being spent somewhere else. So if we're talking about kind of trying to rebalance the economy away from over-dominant big cities towards smaller towns and more economically areas that have a high percentage of economically inactive people, then surely remote working and the consequences that come from that could potentially rebalance the economy. Now, I'm not a labour market economist, I must stress, but that's just my insight.
Mm.
There's also access for people with a disability. I know here in Ireland, if you have a disability and you want to work, but your disability, you know, I know myself, I end up in hospital every now and again, and there's nothing I can do about it. I can't predict when it's going to happen, which makes it very difficult for anybody to employ you. Whereas now we're moving towards a universal basic income in parts of Europe, which would make it far, far easier for people with a disability to maintain work, and also those breaks that come with it, where you're going to end up needing treatment or in hospital or something, that you can weather those breaks. Whereas before this, you had to seek permission to work as well as get a disability payment. So hopefully that's all gone out the door. Hopefully it will be that you can have a universal basic income that'll get you through the lean times, and that you can also work on top of that as well. That's what's been sorely needed for people with a disability for a very long time.
But I think there's a slight problem with that, Martin, which is my concern with things like universal basic income, a great idea as many people say it may be. You have a universal basic income, that's fine, that's a great idea. But what you can't do with that is you can't then strip away disability benefits or incapacity benefits or things like that that people need. It has to be universal basic income, yes, but alongside the existing structure of benefits and entitlements that allow disabled people to go about their daily lives and soak up the extra both time and financial costs of being disabled.
Now, the big fear I always have is when I see certain people who do agree with UBI, they say it from the perspective of, if we give someone a UBI, we can then shrink the public sphere further. So we'll say, well, we gave you your UBI, now go out and buy private health insurance. We gave you your UBI, now, you know, you've lost your access to your GP or whatever the case may be. So you can't, it certainly can't be used as a way of just of shrinking the public sphere. If anything, this crisis has told us that we need to ramp up the supports and the public sphere itself.
Exactly, I completely agree with that. Over here in the UK, we've got something called Access to Work, which is as part of our reasonable adjustment thing coming out of the Equality Act. If you need support in the workplace, you need assistive technology, you need tax to inform work, you need the things that enable you to get into the workplace and properly thrive as a disabled person or person with chronic illness or whatever, then there is that pot of money there that enables you to do that, which I know I've benefited from in terms of assistive technology and things that allow me to do my job just as good as anybody else. Whereas sometimes, I know not necessarily at the BBC, but previously when I've gone for jobs that maybe haven't necessarily been in the media, the challenge has been trying to get the people to hire me and trying to see my potential, because they just see, oh, extra costs, extra things we're going to have to pay for with a disabled person. Whereas if there exists a fund, a pot of money that can make those adjustments to allow the person to work, be it assistive technology, be it technology needed for remote working, whatever it may be, and that can potentially lead to disabled people being more included in the society rather than being excluded. But it's that having that pot of money that enables people to do that, that enables people to have that expression. And that can, that oftentimes, yes, sometimes it does come from businesses, own pots of money, but oftentimes that can come from the state, because the state can be the equaliser in such a system.
And there was a great opening to Newsnight last night on BBC Two, where the cost of what's happening now around coronavirus was discussed, and that it is affecting those who are densely populated, poorer, with a disability, older. It is affecting the usual left out people in society, those who are left behind. It's affecting them disproportionately. And it's, the question is, in the future, who pays for this? Are they going to try and level this on top of all the people who are suffering already? Are they just going to try and say, well, as Tony says, print money, it's only fiat currency anyway, let's get through this? But who pays the bill at the end is going to be very, very important in regard to disability services and a lot of other services as well.
I could only, as a BBC journalist, unfortunately, I could only speak from my personal experience rather than a political perspective per se. But what I will say is I'm from North England, I'm from across borders from Liverpool. And this is an area that suffered quite a lot under the austerity cuts that were made between roughly 2009 and 2015, 2016. And it really, really suffered. So councils in my part of the world have gone from funding lots and lots of opportunities, really being opportunity enhancers for their communities, to being bodies that are really solely concerned with adult social services, particularly around social care, because the NHS still isn't really able to deal with that area. Now, if you are a disabled person, you do need care and support a lot of the time. That is, sometimes that is going to come out of your own pot of money, but more often than not, it's going to come out of the social care fund. And one of the concerns I've got an elderly grandma who has to have somebody to go in every day to look after her. And one of the concerns I've got is, with this crisis, is her carer going to be able to go in to get to see her? And that's magnified many, many times across the country by many disabled people who need people to go in and do their cooking for them, do their cleaning for them, do their washing for them. To be fair, as I do myself when I'm down in London. Because I'm an okay average cook, but I do need help with it. And similarly, I need help with somebody to do my cleaning. And if I can't go out and do that because of the crisis, that means my quality of life is going to suffer exponentially. And if you don't have the correct resources there to enable people to do that, be that from local councils or national government, if you don't have a pot of money there that enables disabled people to be able to do, to be able to have a good quality of life, a decent quality of life during this crisis and after this crisis, then they are going to suffer. And if the cuts are going to come, I guess they can't come at the expense of groups that are already marginalised and have already had so much taken away from them as a result of the various economic crises, as a result of the social care cuts.
I think that's really well put, because, and I have seen positive noises from the Bank of England in terms of, the commencement of what Dave McWilliams continues to call helicopter money. But we've seen the talk of this now commencing, and that will mean that, as Martin pointed out, the people who are already vulnerable and maybe lower paid, or maybe in certain, you know, working class and manual labor, where they don't have the luxury of being able to work from home. They are stacking our shelves, and they are the people who keep our economy going. And you know, there is a chance, and that's what, again, part of the reason we're doing the no going back is because we want to make sure that we show a value for these people as things go on, because this has opened our eyes that it's not the fund managers, it's not the people like me who are moving debt around that saved the world. You know, it's the people who are cleaning the checkout tills because people need to go and buy their food and they need them to be clean so we stop the spread of this. It's those people who are doing it, who are doing crucial work. I just in terms of a it's a pretty big question, but if there was a couple of things that you would like to say we must adapt now as we start to come out of this crisis, what would be your kind of top couple ones, Ellis?
Big thing for me has to be greater acceptance of remote working, because Martin, as you were saying, and you're right to say there's days when you can't go into hospital. Sorry, the days when you are in hospital and you can't go into work, the days when you are at home recuperating, convalescing, and you can't go into the office. But if you are able to take part and connect with people and do your work and do your labour and maintain your health with things like remote working, it can make things very, very advantageous. It can also shift the economy away from big areas, away from areas that have already got a lot of stress, really, in terms of, you guys have spoken a lot in your podcast, as I know, about housing stock and about access to housing stock, particularly in Dublin, in Galway and in Cork. Now, if you have something like remote working, that could potentially reduce the stress on those areas. So I think remote working could potentially be a big equaliser, but I do think we have to realise that as a result of this crisis, a lot of thanks and a lot of gratitude. And I hope that's not just socially and, you know, conversationally and performatively. I hope financially as well is going to go towards people like the carers, the cleaners, the NHS staff, the public service, the people who do a public service in our countries around the world on a day-to-day basis. I hope their work and their opportunities are recognised, and that they don't face cuts, and they're going to bet if businesses do have to make cuts, it's a lot of the time it's going to be the lower paid staff that are going to be the first to go. It's going to be the more vulnerable staff, the younger staff, the staff who remember the what political scientists and sociologists call the precariat, those who don't have contracts, who are going to be the first to go. And I hope that maybe a lot of those members of the precariat, a lot of those who've been providing vital services, and I hope that they don't see their wages, see their livelihoods suffer as a result of this crisis. And that's a real challenge.
I don't think when we get through the other side of this, because I don't think we're coming through anytime soon, but I don't think when we get through the other side of this that those who, and let's be honest, that those who have put their lives at risk for a wage, because that's what they are, I don't think they're going to be very quietly put back into a box again. I don't think it's going to be very easy to say, you are the lowest paid, you're Schedule D workers, we really don't care about you. And that's what they were before this. They were Schedule D workers. Now we've found out that our Schedule D workers really should be our Schedule A workers. They're the people who actually keep the wheels greased and keep everything moving. I don't think, even with the political setup as it is at the moment, I don't think the political setup is going to survive it. And I don't think the notion that you can levy austerity on Schedule D workers is ever going to hold water again. I think if you tried it, you'll have what I call revolution, which is reboot plus revolution is revolution. And when we bring this thing back up, we need to bring it back up in favor of everybody, not just the few.
How, Martin? How? That's great. That's very eloquent. That's everything like that. But how do you do that? How? I studied collective action in Barcelona. It's one of my great passions.
Yeah.
I have a big question about those things. Those ideas, they sound wonderful. It's great. It's fantastic. But it's a how. At the moment, we don't have that infrastructure. We don't have the collective action organizations, be it in our communities, be it in our workplaces, that are able to do that. And I think it's more than collective action. Oftentimes it's about connective action as well. Because there's a heck of a lot of freelancers out there. Even in my own family, there's a heck of a lot of people who aren't necessarily on formalized contracts, who don't have the rights to join a trade union. But they're doing essential services, they're performing essential tasks. How are they going to be recognized, and how do you organize them to have a collective voice to go up? And you know, you go back to the 1970s in this country, we had a very strong tripartite agreement between the trade union and Congress, the Confederation of Businesses, and the government, and that exists in the Nordic countries. But I guess the big question of that is, how do you come up with some such tripartite agreement or representation and recognition of workers when so many in our economies aren't necessarily working in formalized workplaces and they're working remotely, they're working as freelancers or whatever. How do you do that? That is a big challenge in terms of collective action, in terms of the organization of people.
I do think there are methods. I do think there are, you know, in terms of growing the reducing the precariat, growing empowering the workforce, and then and basically growing the trade union movement, growing pushing back on workers' rights, and working with civil liberty groups and things like that to ensure that we have state accountability. But that's, you're right, it doesn't, you can't just flip the switch and it happens overnight. It won't work like that. My big thing would be that we look upon, as you said, the Nordics that work certain. You can be a magpie. I hope that you can steal the best ideas from across the globe and try and implement them. It's a slow burner. But what it does do, though, I do believe that, you know, if we were to tackle the unemployment level and you can, so good housing policy is good climate policy, which is good employment policy. And which also helps your health service. So if you can give people put them in the workplace, you can get them into other areas, and we can work from those things. I think there's an opportunity here. I just want people to believe that that we can all see this as an opportunity, and not just as something that is going to fizzle away. And sure, we get back to normal. I don't want the words "get back to normal" to almost be banned going forward. I don't want to go back that way.
And to what normal? How do you define the normal? What is normal? What is this concept of normal? I would argue normal actually ceased to exist quite a while ago. We haven't been in normal circumstances since probably the mid-noughties, really. And for many people, there doesn't exist a normal. There exists precarious contracts, precarious labour terms. You know, they can't maybe join trade unions, they can't organise, they feel increasingly detached from their communities. So what is normal for these people? It's okay to talk of a normal, but I don't think we've probably had a normal since 2008. So to go back to a normal is a very kind of, it's a certain kind of normal that benefits a certain kind of person rather than a normal that exists for everybody. And I think, and certainly I've never had a normal experience of the workplace as a disabled worker, because that just doesn't exist. Because you need the assistive technology, you need the things that enable you to get on in the workplace, and that's a real challenge.
I'm kind of reminded of during World War II, when women filled the labour gaps in factories and in services in the UK and across the world. And then once the war ended, they were told, go home and go back to being the little woman inside in the workplace. And I'm kind of reminded of that. And I think this time around, you're not going to be able to say to people, right, go back into your box. I don't think it'll work.
That was to a certain extent during the emergency, yes. But it was especially during World War One that happened, when women were forced to, you know, went into the workplace in great numbers from 1914 to 1918. And then by 1918, when the men came back from the trenches, many of whom had health conditions, had mental health factors at play as well, were told, oh, no, you're going back into the workplace. They weren't given adequate supports that they needed to be able to access their communities. They were told, right, no, go back into the workplace. Your job is there for you. And so forcing women out of the workplace and back into a role in the home in many cases, or in the informal economy. Because I think that's potentially one of the big divides you get when you get a crisis like this. You get women passing from the informal economy to the formal economy during the crisis, and then passing back from the formal economy to the informal economy after the crisis has passed. And that's a concern with this crisis we've got at the moment. We want to ensure that people from marginalised groups, from the precariat, are able to stay in the formal economy and are able to contribute taxes and, you know, things like that, and earn money at a decent rate, so they're able to have a decent quality of life, rather than in the informal economy, where they're not necessarily being able to contribute to society, either fiscally or socially.
Ellis, I think, look, I first of all, thank you so much for your time. You're such a brilliant voice on Twitter. People can follow you on Twitter. They can see your work on the BBC World Service. You speak three languages, for God's sake, and I mean, like, you're an accomplished guy. And I have to say, I'd be more friend. Yes, let's look at the solutions. Let's have this conversation again in a few weeks as well, and let's see how things begin to shape up, and, you know, within Ireland and within the UK, and we can maybe get a sense of where as the lockdown goes on. Because someone has said we're 3 weeks into our lockdown here. It was 10 weeks in Wuhan, you know, and we need to start.
That's with, I mean, I've been covering this crisis for BBC World Service on a day-to-day basis. Mm. Since the 23rd of January, the start of my job at World Service. And one of the things that's really interesting is, yes, that is 10 weeks in Wuhan, but that's 10 weeks of a total lockdown. Yeah. That's 10 weeks of just being confined to an apartment, of not being able to go out to the shop. Tony, I know you, if you're running, I got my hand cycling around park and everything like that. That's never mind you 2 kilometers from home and one thing another. That's just completely not being able to go out. That's 10 weeks of a total lockdown. So if you're looking at it in Europe, potentially that could, in the European countries that are affected but are doing partial lockdowns or lockdowns at the moment, that could be a really, really, I know in Spain it's been going on for kind of 3-4 weeks now. And it's not really showing any signs of abating in key regions, and I think we could be in this for a while, really. Yeah. And that's the challenge for a lot of people who, you know, maybe don't have fixed work, maybe don't have the opportunities that they need to be able to get on. If they have been working in a workplace, they've been working remotely, and then the crisis comes along, are they going to be able to continue doing their jobs? But that's that only time will tell in that sense. And it's been great speaking to you guys. As I say, long time listener, first time caller, and yes, I'm going to go back to being a tortoise and hibernating on the Wirral now.
Well, I think the Wirral is a nice place to be. I think it's a lovely place to be at the present moment in time. I mean, at least you have something to look at. I'm in suburbs, box after box after box after box, with different painted doors, and there's nothing to look at. Nothing. It's very boring.
So let's talk about that. Why do people move to suburbia? Why do people move to the suburb?
Access to the cities.
I guess, but if you've no longer got a lot of white collar jobs needing that access in the cities, where jobs can be done remote.
Oh, I'd be in Dingle. If you, that'd be it. I'd be down. Why would you be anywhere else in Ireland?
Seriously. Mind you, bloody heck, Dingle's expensive, mate. Jesus.
Yeah, well, now they'll have to get rid of all the holiday homes down there. So hopefully You know, they'll the prices. But that's another thing that's coming too. I mean, there's so much. The property market is ready for a huge tanking as well. And, you know, I know people say, oh, equity, negative equity. Look, it's long overdue. It's long, long overdue. And let's not do the same thing we did the last time. Let's not commodify it to bits and force the prices back up again. Let's make it accessible to everybody. But that's kind of the view on everything. Let's make work accessible to everybody. Let's make housing accessible. Let's make transport accessible for everybody who needs it. But I think we're all locked in. It's kind of we're in the world's biggest prison, which is the world. And generally when people are locked up in prison, they kind of float ideas around to each other. If you look back through history, groups that have been incarcerated have organized quite well. And I think that we have that period yet to come where we all organize online and say, what future do we want?
That is an unusual analogy, Martin, to go with, but nonetheless holds true historically. There's been some ideas come out of men gathered in prisons, yes.
But you guys were talking to Saoirse Mac here the other day, who I think is a fantastic voice on these things.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think it's really, really interesting is potentially if people are, you know, can no longer go 2 kilometres or whatever, what do we really need? Can only go 2 kilometres away. Their cars are going to be sitting on the driveways. Mm. They're not going to be using the cars. They're not going to be going around as much. That could potentially have a really interesting impact on the environment and the economy. Mm. We've been talking about, you know, obviously, you know, it is a catastrophe what's going on at the moment. But one of the things that could potentially happen that we've seen in China are the CO2 levels and the NO2 levels actually significantly decreasing. And if you get into that scenario, it could be good for the environment, but bad for people.
Well, I happen to think that we can try and steal, as I said, as a magpie, try and steal the good things, and let's stick to the good. Let's hope we can take some more good things out of this. I know the worst is ahead in many cases, and it is a global tragedy. But we need to understand that there are lessons that we need to learn from this as a society, and taking back the public sphere, I think, is one of the main things to include all of the public and not just a certain kind of as I don't know if anybody saw when I Senator Lynn Ruan absolutely destroyed me on a WhatsApp conversation the other day when I asked her, did I win? She said, you're a straight white middle class man, aren't you? You know, so the world is made for me, but we need to include a lot more than that, you know. Ellis Palmer, thank you so much for your time, and we really appreciate it, and we will try and touch base with you again.
Thanks,
Alice, for coming on and have a chat with us. Look, bit of housekeeping, folks. We are working very hard to keep these podcasts coming to you. When I tell you Tony is frazzled, he is frazzled. There is no doubt about it. So what we'd like you to do is sign up and become a patron at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And please get a few bob in there. Keep us rocking and rolling. Thanks again, Alice.